Hello, and welcome to Independent Thinking, the weekly podcast from Chatham House. I am not Bronwyn Maddox. I'm Leslie Vinjamori. I direct our U.S. and Americas program here. I'm sitting in for Bronwyn, who is in Japan this week. It has been quite a week for those of us following the U.S., its politics, its foreign policy. It's Super Tuesday, Biden State of the Union. There's a lot to discuss here. We're here as an international affairs think tank to look at what's happening in the United States, but especially to try and make sense of the direction of a travel in America's foreign policy, how its politics are likely to shape that, what it means for America, and especially for those of us in Europe and the rest of the world, to see Donald Trump emerge or reemerge as the presumptive nominee in the Republican Party, if he ever went away, of course. And what does it say about the future character of America's foreign policy? We are also very curious about Joe Biden, about what a second Biden term would mean. Jeremy Cliff has said, and many others, that Joe Biden is America's last Atlanticist president. I'm curious if our contributors this week feel that's true. But as we know, this was Super Tuesday. Americans turned out across, I think it was 15 states and one U.S. territory to vote in Republican and Democratic primaries. And as many people expected, we have Donald Trump and Joe Biden likely to square off in November for what many people see as a rematch. We saw Nikki Haley leave the Republican race despite some support. She took Vermont, which wasn't necessarily expected. But the real question for us, how is the world, both America's allies, its partners, and its enemies, how are they likely to respond if Donald Trump returns to the White House? Big questions. And tremendous contributors this week joining me. We have Ben Smith, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Semaphore News in the United States. Welcome to you, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining me down the line from Dartmouth, New Hampshire, and a professor at Dartmouth College, Jennifer Lind, who is also an associate fellow at Chatham House on our U.S. and Americas program. Welcome to you, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great to have you both. This is great for me, especially. So let's start with Super Tuesday. We'll go in sequence. Tell us, maybe I can turn to you first, Ben. What did you make of Super Tuesday? Maybe if you could even tell us how significant Super Tuesday is. We have a very international audience here. What were your key takeaways from the day?
You know, I mean, the American political system has this strange feature that instead of being in the primary process, instead of everyone in the country voting on one day, it rolls out as a narrative. It's a story of kind of setbacks and triumphs as they march through all these different states. And Super Tuesday, to some degree, is the culmination of that when many states vote. At least that's how it often works. This year, it was pretty much Donald Trump just sort of marching steadily to victory, beating Nikki Haley pretty much everywhere. You know, handfuls of people supported her, brought her to victory in Vermont and in Washington, D.C., not the real Republican heartland. But it really proved very clearly that it's Donald Trump's party now. You know, although one that he has not quite been able to unite. And I would say that was the only red flag, that Nikki Haley, who represents the pre-Trump Republican Party, basically, and you know, is a very talented avatar of that party, you know, was drawing 30-40% of voters. Some of those weren't really Republicans. They were Democrats who hate Trump so much that they were looking for an opportunity to show up somewhere and sort of, you know, strike a blow against him. But there's clearly some segment of people who vote in Republican primaries who remain really alienated by Trump, and he's done basically nothing to woo them.
Let me come to you, Jennifer. You're in New Hampshire.
Yes.
New Hampshire was the state, you know, obviously the primary took place before Super Tuesday. It was the state where a lot of people thought Nikki Haley would do best. She's now left the race. What did you make of Nikki Haley and her effort to make traction in the Republican Party?
Yeah, so she was quite popular in these parts. We're right next to, here in Hanover, New Hampshire, we're right next to Vermont. It's just across the river, actually. So she clearly did well in Vermont. The 11 conservatives who live in the state evidently voted for her instead of Trump. And then she did well in the New Hampshire primary, although not as well as she had hoped. But New Hampshire is a real quirky place. We are very proud of historically being first in the nation, and everybody was pretty angry with Joe Biden for conferring that on South Carolina. So we'll see what happens next time. But anyway, New Hampshire is very quirky. We like to get to know our politicians. Nikki Haley spent a lot of time here. People liked her for that. She had pretty decent sized crowds, although again, not to the extent that she was hoping to see an impact. And I think that just is in line with the broader narrative, which is she did represent a more sort of the traditional, at least traditional foreign policy, and in many other ways, traditional wing of the Republican Party, who was trying to push back against the Trump phenomenon. And that, of course, as we see decisively on Super Tuesday, has failed.
Let me ask you both a question before we move squarely into the conversation about foreign policy. And I guess it's, you know, is this about Nikki Haley and Donald Trump, or is this about Republican internationalism and whatever we think of Trump as being, neo-isolationism or isolationism or transactional? Or, you know, how much of this is just about the cult of a person, which is Donald Trump, and, you know, Nikki Haley not being able to compete with that, as opposed to two radically different ideologies, and the party has clearly moved towards one? It's a tough question, but I think it's one that we're all very curious about. Let me come to you first, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump is probably a pretty familiar character for people who follow global politics, which is your audience. I mean, you know, whether it's Boris or Milei or, you know, a range of other leaders, many of whom have basically the same haircut. they obviously speak for and represent this strain of populism that, you know, that people are, that is very appealing and isn't, you know, on one hand, isn't tightly tied to policy, like Milei in a way is this very conventional North American Republican politics at his core, but has some commonalities, and this, you know, the intense focus on immigration is a big part of it. Now, this is actually sort of a policy stance in a way, although it's, you know, very kind of emotionally delivered. And I mean, obviously people were not voting for a platform here, but there is there's certainly a policy element to what Trump stands for that's different from traditional Republicans.
Jennifer, on that?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question in terms of, was it Trump, the charismatic individual, that prevailed, or was it something about Trump's platform, either domestic or foreign policy? And I would say that foreign policy was, I would not imagine, was the biggest draw for Trump voters, partly because his views on foreign policy are not particularly well explained, well developed. They seem pretty ad hoc. They seem changeable in terms of the things that he said during his campaign and then what he actually did as president. I think that it's probably more something about his personal charisma and then very much more of the domestic agenda. In terms of him as a person, he offers sort of straight talk at a time when many politicians, and particularly the Democrats, are policing speech, right? Telling people you cannot say such things, and people are feeling like they're being censored and muffled, and he just busts out and says things, right? And so there's that that's sort of just about who he is. There's, of course, his big issue of immigration, which he really ran with at a time when people weren't talking about it, and certainly Democrats weren't thinking about it. And even back to the kind of censorship issue, Democrats won't even kind of let people talk about it, right? Using the words that people would normally use to talk about it. They say, you can't say such things. And so all in all, I would say that it's some combination of his personal charisma plus the domestic issues. On the foreign policy front, I would say, you know, there's points that he makes that do resonate. You can't create something out of nothing. So when it comes to talking about China as a competitor, that certainly resonates. When it comes to talking about burden sharing, you know, that resonates too. People are, you know, thinking about that. But again, I would say foreign policy is not the big draw to the average Trump voter.
You're both right to say, you know, this isn't about foreign policy primarily domestically. You're also right, Ben, to say that he's a very familiar character. It doesn't even take turning to Boris. We just all outside of America watch Donald Trump because he has for so long really claimed the stage. But you know, the comparison runs foul pretty quickly. You know, as we know, Boris Johnson was internationalist in one key dimension, which really separated him out from Donald Trump, and that had to do with Britain's and America's support and defense of Ukraine. And, you know, Boris was at the forefront of a certain kind of internationalism as expressed in Britain's Integrated Review. And he liked to differentiate himself from Donald Trump on these dimensions. Let me on that moment turn towards this question that Europe is very preoccupied and rightly preoccupied with, which is, what is this election going to be? And what is it going to mean for America's support of Europe, its support of Ukraine, its policy towards Russia, its participation in NATO? And it's something that I know you've both followed a lot through, you know, your own work, through following these two candidates. And rather than maybe starting with the Trump question, let's ask the Biden question. If Biden is reelected, you know, some people think that there is a direction of travel that is almost inevitable in the United States, that the U.S. is not going to continue to, even if the supplemental is passed, it's not going to pass more funding in support of Ukraine, partly because, you know, the Republicans are very vocal in Congress, partly because the country is growing weary of spending money in support of Europe and Europe's security and thinks Europe should do more. And so there's, you know, there's a basic question. How significant is this election when it comes to America's support of Europe in general and Ukraine in particular? And what would Biden be able to do even if he wants to support Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you said about the direction of travel is really obviously true. You know, I mean, if you look at sort of America's international commitments, you know, Obama started attempting to withdraw from Afghanistan. Trump set up basically a kind of a framework and a negotiation for withdrawal, and Biden withdrew. And sort of partisan American politics do make it look like there's these huge swings, but there's a lot of continuity, you know, and they are all feeling the same sort of political pressure, which is that lines about how we need to stop investing in, you know, roads and borders in Ukraine and start investing in our own roads and borders, which have always been politically powerful in the U.S. And I think kind of to some degree, there was sort of an elite consensus not to go there, you know, are very resonant here. And, you know, I think the Republican Party is starting to feel pressure from its base, not just to disengage from Ukraine, but also a lot of skepticism about all this money that we're putting into supporting Israel, including people who support Israel on the right. And so I think that is a broad direction of travel. And I think Biden in a second term, you know, depending on who controls Congress, and that matters a lot, it's going to be harder and harder to get any Republicans or many Republicans to vote in support of funding Ukraine. But Trump, on the other hand, is totally unpredictable, sort of how fast he'd go, how he would do it. I mean, he likes to see himself as a deal maker, and often his positions are sort of negotiating positions, but hard to know where that takes you.
And it's not only the question of what Trump would do with respect to Ukraine, it's also what would Trump do with respect to Russia, which is obviously a highly related question, but it is also a separate question. What would America's Russia policy be? And there it seems like the difference might be more stark. Jennifer, let me come to you on that. Do you agree with Ben? Is this kind of, you know, things are moving in this in a singular direction? The idea that we have a policy that would differ radically between these two candidates. And this is, I think the view in Europe is that there is a very likely to be a very significant difference between the two candidates. I think that's partly hopeful. But what is your take on this?
I think that's certainly true. Obviously, these are two candidates that when they tell us what they think about foreign policy, they express extremely different views. And then also just taking a step back from the men that we're talking about, just looking at changes in the world, I think Europeans need to understand that there are big changes in terms of the rise of China, the US-China competition, where Europe is just not the central focus of American foreign policy. The central focus is working on containing this China threat. So the alliances in East Asia were the ones that sort of took the back seat during the Cold War, at least, you know, in peacetime. But today it's basically reversed. So today the key theater is Asia. And the alliances there are the ones that are really essential for dealing with China. Europe is an area where we have this sort of fading power of Russia. And it's not going down without a fight, apparently, right? So it's still very much a security problem. But it's a situation where we have extremely rich, technologically advanced countries that easily have the capability to handle that threat. And the threat in Asia is just different according to the American viewpoint. So in terms of the direction of travel, as you identify it, Ben rightly took us back to the Obama era, right? Where Obama talked about the need to rebalance to Asia. And so that's stemming from these broader geopolitical trends that are going on. That's a reaction to those trends. And so regardless of who's in the White House, the focus on Asia to the expense of energy and focus on Europe is kind of inevitable.
You spend a lot of time looking at Asia. You're expert on Japan. You have a book coming out on China. You travel to the region a lot. How are America's allies in the Asia Pacific thinking about the possibility of a second Trump presidency? Are they hedging? What are they doing?
They are certainly concerned. This is obviously the number one topic among U.S. allies in terms of who are we going to be dealing with over the next several years. They're worried about the future of U.S. security guarantees under Trump's leadership. He said some not very nice things about Asian allies, just as he said about NATO allies, particularly South Korea. But there are some key differences with Europe. So first of all, as I said, Asia is home to what Americans see as the central geopolitical competition, the U.S.-China competition. And so the health of those alliances are pretty important. Then there's the U.S.-Japan alliance, which I think is really healthier than it's ever been. And this health will continue to be robust if Japan continues to step up its defense capabilities, which it's shown signs of doing. The Japanese also, when Trump was elected in 2016, they were very careful about developing a strategy for managing him. I think Shinzo Abe was the first foreign leader to go visit him at Trump Tower after the election. The Japanese cultivated friendly ties with members of Trump's family. They sort of offered him trade-related concessions at the Mar-a-Lago summit that they knew he would particularly be interested in. So the Japanese, you know, to be clear, they're worried this is an unpredictable person, and if he's elected, they're not sure what's in store. But they do know that they handled him very successfully in the past, and that probably gives them some confidence that they can likely do this again. And then ultimately, they have the confidence that their security interests are very much aligned with those of the U.S. at this point.
Ben, when you talk to Americans who are engaged in the conversation about politics and even foreign policy, where are they on China? Do they think, you know, Donald Trump has our back, he knows how to manage China, he's the right president for the future? If this is the main geopolitical threat, we need somebody who's strong in the White House and Trump's our person? Or do they kind of respond to Biden's effort to manage this relationship? You know, we all know that the balloon took us into a very bad place, and the effort to kind of bring it down through diplomacy, how has that been received? Or is it the American public has moved on beyond this conversation?
I mean, you know, there are a lot of different tracks here. I think that the, you know, Congress and the White House are sort of back on track in terms of the relationship with China, but it is a very kind of tough relationship and there's no real thaw. Although there's, I think, more normal diplomatic contact. And TikTok is front of mind on the Hill for sure, partly because TikTok, the day of the State of the Union, unleashed its users to make floods of calls to members of the Commerce Committee who were about to pass a TikTok ban effectively, or a forced sale bill. And it really backfired immediately. The members, you know, receiving calls from 11-year-olds in school with the school bell ringing in the background saying things like that they were going to kill themselves if TikTok was taken away, pretty much confirmed everything that every member of Congress fears about TikTok. And the ban passed 50-0 basically immediately after these calls, which I think it was actually kind of a huge miscalculation that could have consequences for the company. The other striking thing is Biden didn't spend a lot of time talking about China. Trump doesn't, you know, the U.S. public in the space for foreign policy is always kind of to the degree that it gets wrapped around domestic policy. And right now you've got borders and Israel and the kind of isolationism around Ukraine. And I don't think that means that people's views have shifted on China, but it really, at this particular moment, seems kind of tertiary to the presidential campaign.
You mean, in the State of the Union, we didn't hear a lot about China.
Not that he skipped it, but, you know, Israel, the big fight in Washington right now is about Israel and Ukraine. And the big emotional, to the extent Americans are ever paying any attention to foreign policy or kind of feel emotional commitments around it, Ukraine and Israel are where the attention and action are.
It's a treacherous path for the president, talking about Israel, talking about Palestine. It came quite a ways into the State of the Union. I don't know if you had a response to the foreign policy dimension. A lot of people before the State of the Union were saying this will be an address that is all about domestic priorities, all about the economic strategy. Biden needs to communicate his success more effectively. And then he opens with Ukraine. What was your response to the State of the Union, Jennifer? You know, apart from the sort of, you know, the delivery and the, we've talked about the polarization and the partisanship, but the foreign policy part of it, were you struck by the president's words or the amount of time he spent on this and not on China, as Ben has reminded us?
Yes, I think Ben's right, where the issues that President Biden did talk about in the State of the Union with respect to foreign policy are very much the sort of ripped from the headlines issues that are going on right now and that people are really thinking about quite a bit. They are thinking a lot about Israel and Gaza. We're constantly hearing about just the absolute tragedy that is unfolding in Gaza. People are torn about, you know, Israel just experienced this unbelievable national trauma. And so many people just so deeply sympathize with this. But at the same time, we're watching this unfolding humanitarian disaster in Gaza. And what do we think about this? How do we react to this? Right. So people are wrestling with that. And the media are bombarding people with images. And then there's obviously debates within the Democratic Party going on here. So there's so much controversy. And that made it into the State of the Union, I think, because quite rightly, the president and his team understand that people are thinking about that. And then also for Ukraine, how much do Americans want to continue aiding Ukraine is an interesting question. Obviously, in the Republican Party, we've seen decreasing support. So I think that's been the poll data results. That's been the headline there. Democrats, I think, still are pretty strong on saying we should be continuing to do what we're doing. But in terms of asking why did the president spend so much time, and as you note, really just lead off with Ukraine, I think it's because it's become a highly polarized issue in American politics. It's because it's such a polarized, dramatic issue within the Republican Party. And so clearly all of that drama is going on and it's attracting a lot of attention. But then at the base of it, we have to come back to, but how much do the American people actually, like is this, they're interested in the drama, but how much do the people actually have a stake in the outcome is an interesting question. On the China part, I have to say, I was pretty stunned by the absence of discussion about China. Maybe it's a good thing. I'm not sure what we should take from it. When we're engaged in what I believe is probably decades-long competition, it's sort of a tectonic shift that we're living amongst. And so there's not as many headlines necessarily. So yeah, we hear about banning TikTok and we hear about balloons and this sort of thing. But, you know, Americans and people overseas need to understand this is our strategic focus. The China question is what the Pentagon is thinking about all day long. So the fact that got little play in the State of the Union only reminds us that that's a rather theatrical event rather than one with significant policy substance.
Ben, I'll give you my take on this, and I want to get your response. I think the reason that we heard about Ukraine, it's not that the president, and we know he cares deeply about European security, he cares deeply about the defense of Ukraine, but I think that a lot of what President Biden seemed to be doing in the State of the Union was attacking his so-called predecessor first for not defending democracy in Ukraine, and then quickly for not defending democracy in America. And on China, there's not, you know, there is difference, but there's not a lot of difference. They both see China as a real challenge. But that theme of we are faced with a potential future return of Donald Trump. And this man does not care about democracy. He doesn't care about it in Europe. He doesn't care about it in America. And he's going to do revenge. What was it? Revenge and retribution. You know, my values, what did he say? My values are about democracy and equality. And in the end, he said, you know, we don't always get there. We believe that Americans are born equal. We don't always deliver, but we haven't given up on the idea. And the contrast is with this former president who, you know, attacks democracy everywhere. And at some level, China doesn't really, you know, it doesn't give you that same leverage.
Yeah, China's on some almost the only, and that's not the only, but it's one of the few really bipartisan issues in Congress. I mean, you've got a 50-0 vote on it, which is not a thing you see a lot. And I agree with you that he was looking to draw contrasts, and there's not as sharp a contrast. He was also speaking to Congress specifically, even though he was attacking Trump, and Congress is holding up Ukraine and Israel aid. But there is this also truth about American governance over the last, gosh, like 15 years, that they're constantly pivoting to Asia and getting stuck in the Middle East. And, you know, I mean, I think it's true that the Pentagon wishes it were spending 24/7 thinking about China. They are, in fact, spending a lot of time thinking about how to ramp up the U.S., you know, defense manufacturing base to ship more armaments to Ukraine without depleting the stocks that they think they might need for some future conflict, and simultaneously thinking about how to build a floating pier off Gaza without getting any American soldiers in the line of fire from, you know, Hamas or other Iranian proxies, which is a very, very challenging kind of risky thing to do. And so I best suspect the Secretary of Defense spent a lot of time thinking about those things and has a big stack of China stuff on his desk that he's not getting to.
Yeah. And it, you know, the urgency of the situation doesn't really seem to be met by the solution of something that's going to take a long time to put into place, even though long-term solutions are critical. It has been an extraordinary week, and you've both illuminated a huge amount for us. Maybe I can close with, you know, the question of the hour, of the week, of the month, of the year, which is what should Europe do? And especially, you know, let's be honest, the UK is not in the European Union. What should the UK do as it's thinking about this election? This is a country that, you know, at the UN Security Council, it abstains on resolutions if America vetoes. It follows in America's tracks most often, far more often than not, when it comes to America's defense and security priorities. It is pivoted and cast its gaze on the Indo-Pacific in an era of very tight resources, because it is taking not only the Indo-Pacific seriously, but American power and that relationship with the U.S. so seriously. And it's now faced with possibly the return of a president that just doesn't care about Europe and question mark the UK in the same way. So what should the UK do as it looks ahead and as it, you know, reflects on this quite extraordinary week in American politics? I'm going to come to you first, Jennifer, and then to you, Ben.
The question that allies need to be asking is, you know, what are your interests? What are your national interests? And to what extent do you believe that these overlap with those of the United States at this time of, you know, again, where we're talking about over the past few decades, a tremendous change in geopolitics. We're talking about the rise of a superpower in Asia. And so for Asian allies, they need to be asking this. European allies need to be asking this. I don't want to tell Britain and Europe, hey, you really need to help the U.S. out in Asia. Because I don't know, is that in your security interest? This is a time of scarcity, right? I mean, politics is all about scarcity. And so you have to decide, hey, how should we respond to the rise of China? Is that a threat to us? And you might conclude the answer is, well, no, it really isn't. And so I don't want to tell America's allies what their interests are and how to respond. That's a question for your publics and your political leaders. So the question, though, is what are your interests? To what extent do you see them overlapping with that of the United States? And that's the fundamental issue before we get into, you know, which president is going to be elected and so on.
I like that. And it's quite a statement. We live in a time of scarcity. and you've got to look at your interests. It's not that you do or don't care about values, but you've made it pretty clear on how you think the UK and the rest of the world should be deciding where it invests. Ben, your take on this?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm just a working journalist and don't have a theoretical framework at that altitude, but and I'm not going to presume to give advice. I mean, I do think obviously they'll just, it's totally unpredictable who wins this election and they're going to have to hedge their bets. I mean, I do wonder if...
Is it totally unpredictable, Ben?
Well, I mean, I think it's as predictable that there it'll be one of two candidates. And
so it's unpredictable.
I mean, I wonder whether U.S. allies and quasi allies and everybody else in the world don't sometimes look at what Russia did in 2016 and think, huh, meddling really aggressively in U.S. domestic politics can really pay dividends. And I wonder, you know, the Ukrainians, as September, October, November approach, have got to be thinking about calibrating the war effort toward the U.S. election. I mean, I guess I'm sort of interested in how it'll affect overt, much less covert, sort of policy choices in Israel and Ukraine, you know, among the U.S.'s allies as well as its adversaries.
There's a lot in there. I think we've sort of come to the end. I should conclude by saying we have two tremendous guests today. I would highly encourage you to follow them both. Professor Jennifer Lind is a well-known author. Read her work. Follow Ben Smith on Semaphore and follow our podcasts. You can find all of our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms, as well as through our social media channels. And I have to remind you to say, like us, follow us, subscribe to us, and please do leave us a review. We mean it. We mean it very seriously. To read more from our experts or to find out more about our events, don't forget to visit our website, chathamhouse.org, and you can follow all of our research programs. You'll also find Jennifer Lind on our research programs here on the U.S. and Americas program. Brahman's back next week. It will be very interesting to hear what she has learned about how Japan is thinking about Super Tuesday, the State of the Union, the future of America's global role, our alliance. Let's hope it stays strong and that that Japan considers it to be in its interests, even in a time of scarcity. So that's it. It's goodbye from me, Leslie Vinjamori, and Brahman will be back next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.